Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, cfr.org. We're delighted to have Mark Ligon with us today to talk about the role of international institutions in advancing human rights. Mark Ligon is CFR's Adjunct Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Chair of the International Relations and Security Concentration at Georgetown University's Master of Science in Foreign Service Program. From 2007 to 2009, he was U.S. Ambassador at Large, directing the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons of the State Department. He previously served in the Bureau of International Organization Affairs at the State Department, was a member of Secretary of State Colin Powell's Policy Planning Staff, and served as senior staff member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He recently co-authored the book, Human Dignity and the Future of Global Institutions. Mark, thanks very much for being with us today. I thought it would be great if you could walk us through the main arguments in your book, Human Dignity and the Future of Global Institutions, and your recommendations on the role that multilateral institutions can play in advancing human rights and human dignity.
Well, thanks so much for asking me to do this, and I'm delighted all of you have called in for this and your interest. I look forward to a dialogue. I've just come out with a book that looks at how human dignity ought to be the touchstone for the work of global institutions, whether they be the UN and the World Bank or, you know, newer partnerships like the Global Fund to fight HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, or multinational corporations. I've been interested in the degree to which people are invoking the phrase human dignity rather than human rights as the lingua franca in the world. Both President Bush and President Obama, very different in their style and in some respect their perspectives, have spoken more and more about human dignity in their speeches. And different leaders in the world in recent years have invoked it. And maybe it shouldn't be surprising that a Nelson Mandela or an Aung San Suu Kyi would refer to human dignity. What interests me is people from different faith traditions and cultures. For instance, the Dalai Lama said in 1993, Buddhism recognizes that human beings are entitled to dignity, that all members of the human family have an equal and inalienable right to liberty, not just in terms of political freedom, but also at the fundamental level of freedom from fear and want. From a different faith tradition, the Aga Khan, the hereditary imam of Ismaili Muslims and a major philanthropist, said in a speech, the search for justice and security, the struggle for equality of opportunity, the quest for tolerance and harmony, the pursuit of human dignity, these are the moral imperatives that we must work towards and think about on a daily basis. So what's going on here when you hear human dignity invoked regularly? Is there something special about it that could help guide the work of global institutions, which is what the program I'm associated with at the Council on Foreign Relations studies? Well, human dignity is a concept that is informed by different faiths and secular lines of thinking. I'm a Christian, an Episcopalian myself. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, we think that humans have innate and equal value, all being created in the image of the Creator. A number of other faith traditions have a similar notion. In a different vein, the thinker Immanuel Kant's great contribution to philosophy was that human beings are the ultimate agents. They have inherent value, and they, of course, shouldn't be used as mere means. Some of these ideas of human dignity actually have made their way into global institutions. So Eleanor Roosevelt was the chief negotiator for the United States in the UN forming the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, law professor at Harvard, Marianne Glendon, a Catholic who served as an advisor to the Vatican herself, wrote a beautiful biography of Eleanor Roosevelt's role in the formation of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. And she explained how Eleanor Roosevelt said in the negotiations that the reason that human dignity is put into that declaration, that main document of the UN on human rights, is that it was meant to explain why human beings have rights to begin with. Later in the work of the UN, influenced by the Indian economist and thinker Amartya Sen, human development as the focus of the work of the UN Development Program, having people enjoy agency to apply their, capabilities, what I would call God-given talents, as was the centerpiece of the human development work of the UN. So what is human dignity? Trying to be a serious academic, in this book that my colleague Tony Arend at Georgetown University and I have come out with, we define human dignity as three things. The fundamental agency of human beings to be able to apply their gifts to thrive, agency of people. Secondly, social recognition, because people aren't atomized. There isn't a radical individual situation. Each person lives in a social community, and dignity requires being recognized by others as having inherent value and having a claim to equal access to opportunities. And then finally, because we don't want human dignity to just be a concept that's out there in as an abstraction, human dignity to be meaningful has to be institutionalized in practice and in governance. So, basically what I'm suggesting is that while human rights is the language that the UN and many global institutions, even dialogue about corporate responsibility, uses, that maybe human dignity is valuable both above and below human rights. What do I mean by above and below? Human dignity is kind of a primordial concept. It's the thing that's the umbrella over human rights. It's the reason there are human rights, because there is inherent dignity of all people. But if you take this kind of definition, that human dignity is based on the agency of people and recognition that everybody is a human being in full, even if you're a woman or a Dalit or a migrant in some places where those populations are marginalized, you might actually be able to measure whether human rights are being advanced using this concept of human dignity. It could be a yardstick. Our book suggests that global institutions really are of two types today. We are in what the great international relations scholar Hedley Bull in the UK called years ago in 1977 a neo-medieval world. We're in a world of many more actors than governments. We've got intergovernmental organizations, we've got regional organizations, we've got virtuous and pernicious non-government organizations, from very good, non-profits like Oxfam to political groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And so if you're to talk about global institutions, you need to talk about the traditional ones, the ones made up of governments, and you need to talk about the hybrid institutions or these other ones. Just want to give you a couple of examples from the book of how we look at how human dignity is and might better be promoted by these two different kinds of institutions. One chapter in the book written by our colleague Todd Lindbergh of the Hoover Institution looks at the International Criminal Court. It's a controversial body. Some people think that it could be politicized. Some people think it's wonderful. Some people think that it's focusing too much on Africa. But one thing that people don't really know about the Hague-based International Criminal Court is that it has pretty substantial mechanisms for victim restitution, for helping the victims, not just prosecuting the perpetrators of atrocities. That advances human dignity. Our colleague Anoop Singh, who headed the Asia division of the International Monetary Fund, looks at how that traditional government-based organization has helped build economic opportunity for impoverished people around the world by putting in place rule of law so that there aren't informal economies, but they're legal institutions so that people can keep their property and can have predictable ability to maintain what it is that they work for. But the book also looks at sort of hybrid institutions and partnerships. Perhaps most strikingly, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, which consists of UN agencies, multilateral banks, big foundations like the Gates Foundation, businesses, and NGOs. Our colleague Rosalita Rodriguez-Garcia of the World Bank wrote a chapter about how that Global Fund not only steered funding to give medical treatment to those who had AIDS, but it dealt with the situation that so many HIV patients were stigmatized populations. They were men having sex with men. They were intravenous drug users. They were prostituted people in the sex industry. And that institution helped them get access to treatment, both assisting their agency and also helping them be recognized as human beings in full. And then finally, our colleague Michael Samway, who used to work for the Yahoo Corporation and helped it form its business and human rights program shortly after Yahoo had its troubles in collaborating with the Chinese government on building internet platforms there. He's looked at the way corporations are as important an institution as any other global institution, and they have responsibilities working with illiberal governments if they want to advance people's agency and ability to use the internet. So basically, these are the two types of institutions. And what I think with my co-author, Tony Aaron, we'd like to do is to launch something you might call a dignitarian dialogue. What is there really a consensus across cultures and across faiths or between those who are secular and those who are of faith about whether human dignity is a touchstone to guide the work of global institutions? There ought to be a dialogue about first principles, and where there's disagreement, see if there are ways to incorporate dissenting views. There ought to be dialogue about, so when the rubber hits the road, how do you operationalize human dignity? How does the UN, High Commissioner for Refugees or the Ford Motor Company as global institutions actually, you know, think about promoting dignity in practice? And how do you prioritize tasks? Which thing do you do first? I'm a specialist on human trafficking. I wrote a chapter about partnerships to fight human trafficking in this book. So do you prioritize prosecuting the bad guy for justice, or do you prioritize empowering a survivor of human trafficking? We need a dialogue about what comes first. Where do you have that dialogue? Well, some people would say we need a new meeting at the UN, just like the San Francisco conference and the Fairmont Hotel, which led to the formation of the UN Charter. I'm not really sure that a meeting at the biggest traditional international organization is the way to go. There are some places this dialogue can happen, and I'd like your input of where it can happen in the faith community or ecumenical venues. But some places that might be interesting would be the G20, a group of 20 countries that represent over three-quarters of the world's population and over three-quarters of the share of world GDP. It's been surprising, actually, some regional organizations that you have not stood up for human rights in the past have been stirring themselves and engaging on questions. Even, you know, the Arab League has spoken out about Libya and Syria in a way that would never criticize other governments in the past. The university is obviously an institution where this dialogue can take place, and then finally what you might call the virtual world. The world of the internet might be a place for this dialogue about whether dignity is in fact something that we can come to consensus on. Maybe we can get away from some of the old debates about whether economic rights or political rights come first if we can find a more holistic approach. And I think just as a final idea, you know, since it's the elephant in the room, the United States needs to help facilitate this dialogue. And it shouldn't be a dominant power forcing this idea on others, leading people to suspect that it's a kind of Trojan horse for the American way and American interests. But the United States shouldn't also be a coy bystander if you're to have a dialogue about human dignity. Maybe the United States, still very important, more important than any other single nation, it should at least try to be a cultivator of this dialogue. So anyway, I'd love for you to, you know, raise some questions about specific kinds of organizations and institutions and how they might promote human rights better, or about this overall idea, particularly those of you who are of different faith traditions and you know, active in churches who engage public policy issues. I'd like to know if you think this kind of dialogue might contribute to actually in practice helping marginalized people have more agency and recognition that they're human beings in full.
Thank you, Mark. That was great. Let's open up to the group for questions, comments.
Yes, ma'am. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. And our first question comes from Thomas Walsh with the Universal Peace Federation.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for this introducing me to this intriguing new concept of focusing on human dignity. And can you hear me okay?
I can indeed.
Yeah, just, you know, I fully agree, too, that, you know, the formalism associated with human rights makes it complicated when you drill down, and as you pointed out very well, the problem between negative and positive human rights, and you know, obviously that it becomes something that's associated with certain cultures, and you can be accused of rights being a Trojan horse of sorts. And then the question is whether we move the discussion forward, as you're proposing. I think it's definitely worth a try. And I like it. You know, I was recently at a meeting of the Alliance of Civilizations of the UN in Bali. It was their sixth global forum. And, you know, they have a good interfaith dimension to that. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was there, as well as the High Representative Nasser. But I'm pretty sure I heard the Secretary General using this concept of dignity also in his remarks. So it could be an idea whose time has come. And I just throw out the Alliance of Civilization as a kind of a soft power dimension of the UN that is increasingly the kind of hospitable venue for the religious interfaith component to be built in. The other comment I just draw quickly is that as you were speaking, it also brought to mind how the restorative justice movement has tried to move beyond the kind of legalistic systems of justice that also get bogged down in adversarialness and moving it to something that hopefully takes the discussion to a higher level of sorts. So those are just my quick comments and expression of appreciation.
Well, I want to mostly hear from you all, but two quick thoughts on that. part of the animating part of this is that I worked as the anti-human trafficking ambassador, and I saw how, you know, a free market Republican administration, skeptical about government intervention and certainly skeptical about the UN, the Bush administration, was very active in both fighting HIV/AIDS and human trafficking. And it occurred to me in both of these cases, there were things that had to do with civil liberties and political liberties on the one side and poverty and economic affairs on the other. And I think maybe the United States and, you know, its lawyerly Western way should be a little less rigid about saying that political and civil liberties are separate from and above economic rights. And maybe the human dignity can help us re-engage and shake some old, tired debates in global institutions. The other comment I had is I remember back when the former minister, Jack Danforth, once a senator from Missouri, was the U.S. ambassador to the UN. He proposed having a dialogue on faith and how faith and religion sometimes is a source of conflict at the UN Security Council, and Secretary of State Rice, for whom I worked, said, no, I don't want that to happen there. And I don't know whether Ambassador Danforth was wrong, but I do think maybe the Alliance for Civilizations might be the better place to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question or comment?
Our next question comes from Abbas Barzingar with Georgia State University.
Hi there. I just wanted to say thank you again for the presentation. I wanted to second the motion, really, that the Alliance of Civilizations could help facilitate this dialogue. I had the chance over the summer to spend some time in Turkey, both in the border region by Gaziantep and just north of Aleppo, and also in Istanbul, meeting with Muslim NGOs that were working on the Syria crisis. And I was amazed to hear the kind of language of humanism that came out of almost the rank and file of every organization I dealt with, whether they were sort of liberal, Sufi-oriented Muslim NGOs or the kind of more conservative ones that you would associate with a kind of an Islamist brand. They all adopted a language of human dignity, and I think that would be an interesting place to explore some options. The Alliance of Civilizations has a program in Istanbul, and the question really comes down to at what point, just like in the human rights conversation, just like in religious freedom kind of conversations, at what point do you sort of begin to manage the engagement with illiberal civic actors or illiberal forms of, you know, democratic institutions that are out there that are emergent? I mean, how far can this dignity, you know, this dignity dialogue go without really compromising what would be the conventional understandings of dignity and rights from, you know, from the international norms that we already have, if that makes sense?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, I hope this is a promising avenue to pursue. You know, I saw as an official at the State Department, the United States sort of wrapped around the axle in its efforts to have a dialogue with so-called moderate Muslims to encourage some Muslim communities to embrace pluralism and tolerance so that those who are violent extremists would be winnowed in number. And I wonder whether, you know, some of the ham-handed efforts of communication the United States has made in its public diplomacy would be improved by this being the frame. Mm-hmm. We need to discuss, you know, we need to engage even those who are Islamists. You know, one thinks of you know, those who are in the government in Turkey, to see whether there are some grounds for agreement here. I think perhaps it would help for people to understand that the United States cares deeply about both the political and economic sides of dignity more than some might perceive.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please, or comment.
Our next question comes from Yuri Mantilla with Liberty University.
Professor Lagon, thank you for your presentation. Very interesting. The first point I would like to make is that considering the increasing influence of postmodern ideas and specifically of moral relativism, how do you sustain a human rights perspective that is based on the concept of human worth in an increasing moral relativistic culture? And the second point will be that considering what we are witnessing specifically in the Middle East, in Syria, in Iraq with ISIS, and obviously we see one of the most extreme forms of dehumanization of others, and we see innocent human beings, women, children, being killed in that part of the world. So considering that, I believe that this is obviously a key moment in the history of humankind. Isn't it time for us to make an effort to restore the strength of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights rather than trying to create a new document? We have that. Isn't it time that we try to restore the global influence of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and specifically that we try to promote the fundamental ideas of that declaration to the millennial generation, to the youth around the world? And probably, we could focus on a global conference that attracts intellectuals, attracts, obviously, decision makers. But obviously, we need to work, with emerging leaders, young leaders from around the world.
Well, there's a lot there that you ask that is very rich. So just to respond to some of that, it is remarkable about how some people are actively trying to dehumanize others. I say in my book, look at how human beings crave recognition, in a social context, for an identity. Unfortunately, some people crave recognition in the form of dehumanizing others as a way of their identity, atrocities are committed at the expense of other people. I'm reminded of the statement by Gandhi that it has always been a mystery to me how men can feel themselves honored by the humiliation of their fellow beings. Now, you ask a central question that we've had in mind throughout of developing this book and testing it out on different audiences. Are you going to undercut human rights by talking about human dignity? Should you just stick with the Universal Declaration on Human Rights and the treaties in the UN system that has flowed from it? I do not want to run away from human rights. I want to strengthen human rights. But you mentioned the Universal Declaration. It begins by suggesting that human dignity is the premise. What I hope is to enliven a new reframing of human rights. And I don't want us to undercut all the treaties in the UN that have been created and the successes on the ground for implementing programs that actually advance human rights. But I hope that human dignity could actually strengthen that effort.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question or comment?
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. And our next question comes from Majid Ashi with the Merrimack College.
Yes, hello. Thank you very much. In my research on the effects of child abuse and trauma on the brain, it became very clear to me that it seems that human dignity is a biological necessity and prerequisite for the functioning of humans. When people are basically exposed to abuse in any form, political or war or personal, their biology seems to be goes into a lack of equilibrium. And then there are efforts, psychological efforts, to try to restore dignity. So I wonder, how you're thinking about the human need for dignity might be also connected to the efforts that people do to restore dignity, sometimes in unhealthy ways. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, I'm sympathetic to the idea that sometimes those who have good intentions of trying to restore dignity end up objectifying people. I'll give you an example. I used to be the head of a nonprofit to combat human trafficking, Polaris Project. It runs a national hotline in the United States to fight human trafficking. There's a danger that if you tell the story of a human being who's been victimized in order to promote your nonprofit or to inform people, that you end up turning that person into an object, or, you know, you treat someone as a victim, and you're kind of collaborating and not empowering them again. I think that's true. I think there, this is something that I've been looking at. You all probably recall the famous article by Francis Fukuyama, now of Stanford University, where at the end of the Cold War he asked, had we reached the end of history? Whether the ideological struggle between the U.S. and the Soviet Union and its two camps meant that we were, you know, kind of done with big ideological struggles. And I guess we still have them in different forms, maybe even, you know, a conflict of violent extremists is one of them. But he wrote a book version of this called The End of History and the Last Man. And the underappreciated part of this is he takes a concept from Plato of spiritedness and says that everyone craves recognition. It's a natural aspect of human beings to be recognized as being of value or equal value to people. And I think there is something there that is actually a positive force. And it is natural. Whether by natural you mean biological, or whether by natural you mean natural law, universal truths, or, you know, something that we have because of God, whatever your faith may be. But I think that Fukuyama has something there about this natural desire to be recognized as being of worth.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Again, as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press *1. And our next question comes from John Denker with United Religions Initiative.
Well, first, I'd like to answer your one question. Yes, there are great differences between the cultures and the religions as to what constitutes human dignity. That's one item that makes coming to some universal conclusion rather difficult. However, I'd also like to point out that there are organizations such as mine, the United Religions Initiative, which was founded by Bishop Bill Swing in San Francisco at the request of the United Nations, to form an interfaith group. And Bill soon found out that the religious leaders around the world are rather calcitrant to the idea of forming any kind of UN of the religions idea. So he started at the grassroots level. And so we now have over 700,000 members and approximately 200 local affiliates around the world working at a grassroots level to bring about the idea of human dignity and respecting of interfaith traditions. So I would like to point that out, that I do think that it is going to have to happen at the grassroots level and not from the top down. But the other question I have is, where is the UN Commission on Human Rights in all this, and what are they doing? What is your opinion on them?
Well, let me take the latter question first, because it's easier. I used to be Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizations. For a while, the UN Commission on Human Rights, which gave birth to the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, was perceived as politicized. I don't know whether the criticism of the UN being politicized is a truism because it's a political body, but former Secretary General Kofi Annan believed that, you know, when Libya chaired the Commission on Human Rights and when dictatorial governments sought a seat to try and block criticisms of themselves, it was harmed. It was replaced with a new body, the Human Rights Council, which had a few improvements. One of which was to have more regular meetings to be able to take up emergency situations. Another was a peer review mechanism that every country in the world would get looked at, and it empowers civil society groups. I had felt that, you know, that this body was not much better than the old Commission on Human Rights and would have just the same level of politicization, but it has managed to deal with some of the hardest issues and you know, and look at Iran and look at Syria and look at a whole series of issues that they didn't expect it to be able to take up. But on this particular issue, I've been very happy about something that happened there, which is a sign of perhaps a possibility for interfaith and intercultural understanding. You know, in the wake of the cartoons in Denmark portraying Mohammed in a critical light, and the movie, if you can call it that, The Innocence of Muslims, there have been activities in the UN to try and stop defamation of religion. The problem with efforts on to combat defamation of religion is that they're used by some governments to restrain freedom of expression and used by some governments to persecute those who don't share the majority religion in a country. The UN Human Rights Council managed to, with U.S. negotiation with the Organization of the Islamic Conference, to get around this and actually both try and promote tolerance avoid defamation of religion, but also not run roughshod over freedom of expression. That's something that I would not have thought a few years ago would even be possible at the Human Rights Council. Yeah, there are different definitions of dignity and different faiths, and I do think there needs to be something of a bottom-up approach. However, my point about the United States not being coy, I think sometimes a dialogue has to be framed, and there needs to be an invitation to the party. And so while there needs to be grassroots efforts at a dialogue, I think that, you know, this is something so vitally important that faith leaders and some national leaders should take it on.
Thank you. Next question.
Again, to ask a question or make a comment, please press star 1. And our next question comes from Abbas Barzigar with Georgia State University.
Hi there. Just two quick follow-up questions. One, in our previous conversation about previous discussion, really about engaging not just the moderate Muslims that look exactly like we do and think exactly like we do about politics and society. What kind of obstacles do you see within various government institutions here in the United States and international institutions to get over that barrier of engaging so-called mainstream conservative Islamist organizations? That's one question. The second question is, are there other examples like the one that you just pointed out about the OIC and the Human Rights Council where you've seen this kind of dialogue produce some kind of tangible result, specifically in the development sector, maybe? Where is the human dignity conversation, you know, and faith intersecting in the development sector? Any kind of tangible, you know, things that have happened that are on your radar that I might have missed?
Great questions. you all are uncorking more and more complicated, broad questions, and I welcome it. The main thing I'd like to focus on is the latter. It is difficult engaging questions of faith. My colleague here at Georgetown University, where I'm a professor, Catherine Marshall, who's at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs, she for 6 years was the counselor to the president of the World Bank, Jim Wolfensohn, and her role was to try and, from the World Bank, and engage faith leaders, voices, and actors. And let me tell you, the World Bank was pretty allergic to that. and there were even, I think, some people who were from the faith side of the dialogue who were not comfortable or poised to talk to an institution whose job is to, you know, to talk to you about talk to people about economic development. But I think there are possibilities. If it's possible, even in the World Bank, for this to happen, then maybe it's possible elsewhere. On your first question, look, you know, the United States decides it's not going to formally talk to some people. I think it actually was a mistake for many years, the United States bankrolling Hosni Mubarak and accepting his false dichotomy, either me or the Muslim Brotherhood. The United States should have been engaging other voices for years even more vigorously and talking to the Muslim Brotherhood. But even when there are sanctions or limitations on some groups, the United States, in its foreign policy, formally discusses, this is where other tracks of dialogue can exist. The UN has a benefit. You know, it's a place where the United States can talk to Iran or talk to some others, that there can't be a formal channel that exists elsewhere. And hopefully there could be what is called by some track two diplomacy, where there can be dialogue outside of formal government-to-government channels about how there is a common understanding that violent extremism, even if you are a relatively conservative or orthodox believer in a particular faith, that those are, you know, taking actions that target other human beings who, because they're innocent civilians, is utterly anathematic to anybody who believes in basic decency.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
No, ma'am. There are currently no further questions in the queue.
Great. Well, while we're waiting for more to queue up, Mark, could you talk a little bit more about the concept of mosaic multilateralism and how that relates to human dignity in the 21st century?
Yeah. This is another way of saying what I referred to earlier of the scholar Hedley Bull's view of a neo-medieval world, like a complex situation of many different actors. Yeah, it's the alphabet soup of international organizations and lots of different actors. To solve particular problems, we should look to different organizations, institutions, or partnerships. So the UN, and the UN, when it faced HIV/AIDS, decided that the World Health Organization was not going to be sufficient. And it created UNAIDS, which was a collection of different agencies of the UN, and even some other international organizations outside the UN. But then some people had the idea that you needed to include even more actors in this mosaic, and they formed the Global Fund to fight HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, currently headed by the American MD, Mark Dibble. And that engaged other vital actors, businesses, the Gates Foundation, civil society organizations to inform people about how you get AIDS or how you can fight it. And so in this world of mosaic multilateralism, there shouldn't be a cookie-cutter approach that you always turn to one institution, but look for how you can, you know, leverage different capacities. And I think it would be great to see more faith-based organizations in the mix. There are a lot of misconceptions about faith-based organizations. I look at the work of International Justice Mission, a Christian organization that works on human trafficking. If you believed caricatures about faith-based organizations, you would think the faith-based organization, quote, goes on faith and doesn't have any metrics to measure its impact and is not structured and disciplined. And this organization works to fight for those who are poor around the world and don't have access to justice, including human trafficking victims or bonded laborers. And it is disciplined, and it has received massive amounts of money from the Gates Foundation to test what works with metrics. We need lots of organizations connected to different faiths involved in the critical work to help those who are marginalized.
And Mark, what in your view, what would be the way to break down some of those stereotypes and those misconceptions as a practical matter?
Well, I mean, I think it would be good for there to be more things written. You know, people of faith talk about testimonials. I think there need to be testimonials about what has worked to break down stereotypes in that way. And that's something that scholars can do. But I think that perhaps the implications of the book that I've written is, you know, that there should be a dialogue on dignity. It needs to move to an operational mode. It shouldn't just talk about first principles. But perhaps it's in that context where you could see where do faith-based organizations fit into the mix.
Mm-hmm. We have another question, and maybe I'll come back to the your recommendations for the operational or implementation of these comments or this issue. So let's take the next question.
Our next question comes from Blake Jennings with Grace Bible Church.
Hello. We're a church of a few thousand near Texas A&M University. I'm one of the teaching pastors here. And I want to say, in regards to what you were just talking about, that as you think about getting faith-based organizations to buy into these issues, packaging this whole issue within the concept of human dignity is, in my view, a big win. This is a very understandable and compelling concept. When you talk about human rights, it leads to a lot of questions. It can get very complex very quickly. When you talk about human dignity, it's understandable quickly within a faith-based community. Speaking as a pastor, as someone who speaks on Christian theology often, I feel like the way that you have presented this is very easy in our community to get behind and to talk about. So I would just commend you on that. I think that this is very useful language when you want to engage a faith-based community. My question for you, since we are next to Texas A&M University, we interact with thousands of students a week. We see a growing interest among college students in social justice issues, but we don't see a lot of college students who are thinking deeply about why they care about social justice. And so I'm curious about whether you've begun to think about how to take this concept of human dignity and bring it down to the campus level, where you begin to influence the next generation of leaders of nations, of countries, and help them to understand this concept. I think that they're ready to hear it, but I don't think anyone is speaking to them about this idea yet to give them a justification for the social justice issues that they care about.
Well, it makes me think of a couple of things. you know, you hear a lot about millennials in the United States as they go into professional life, wanting something that is more satisfying than merely careerism, and feeling that they're quote making a difference. And I wonder whether human dignity might in fact be the framework. I understand that the World Economic Forum has a young leaders program. And they pursued a dialogue about what language they'd like to use to describe the chief goals of both business community and public policy. And they, having not knowing anything about the book and my not knowing anything about their effort, settled on the concept of human dignity. A Council on Foreign Relations term member, a younger member, in the corporate world is active in that. And I think that tells you something. Question is how do you raise this on a campus? Do you advertise this as a dialogue on human dignity, or do you begin sort of inductively from some case? You know, do you look at atrocities in Syria, or those who are being ravaged by you know, the Ebola virus, and then move from that outward to the concept. And I'd welcome your thinking about that, because I think that, you know, universities should not just be a place where scholars talk to each other, but in fact, those who are being socialized to enter careers to become leaders, you know, should be engaged on this. Absolutely.
Do you want to comment on that?
Sure, if I
can. I'd love
very much.
Yeah, but it would be great if you could just say a few words about it.
Well, we've certainly found that your second approach, building a case study, is the way to pack a room. Students identify very quickly with something that's tangible. And so I think if you can get them into the room and you can talk about something that they can immediately understand, you will have their interest. And then if you can connect that to a deeper foundation that gives them meaning and that helps them to care about something and it not just be a flash in the pan, but be something that's enduring, we have found that to be the best approach. I think, again, your concept of human dignity is useful. I could imagine something here at Texas A&M University where you could actually get leaders from a variety of faith and faith traditions in a room where we can, even with our very different theological positions, we can all agree on the concept of human dignity, and that opens up a conversation. And I think we can also typically agree on the need to interact in some particular case study. For example, human trafficking is a issue that is it's very current, it's very relevant among students at Texas A&M today. You could gather a large number of students to talk about what we do about human trafficking, and then that could become an opportunity to have dialogue even among a variety of scholars and people from various faith communities to talk about some of the deeper questions. It could actually open some wonderful debates and discussions. But I do like your case study idea. I think that you would already be tapping into a lot of energy and momentum that's on campus currently.
You know, I'll tell you, so I may not be a typical person, and I am long past being a youth. In fact, it's, you know, I have a daughter who's an undergraduate right now at Duke. But I will tell you that, you know, it was somehow God's plan for me to work on human trafficking. I just got assigned as a Senate staffer to work with a Christian conservative senator from Kansas, Sam Brownback, and a truly left progressive senator from Minnesota, the late Paul Wellstone. I was wired as the son of Polish immigrants to think about stopping governments from repressing people. And human trafficking is an issue where you need to encourage governments to protect the most vulnerable. And it is actually through this issue that I began to think more about human dignity. And I do wonder whether, you know, similarly, some people who are in their 20s can see an issue and actually sort of look at the world differently through, you know, a proximate case of people's dignity being vitiated.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we have time for one last question or comment.
Okay, our last question comes from Egon Chalakian with the IFR Project at Harvard and Columbia.
Thank you very much. Very interesting indeed. I'm particularly keen on listening to our colleagues express their view from the faith-based community. You know, it's interesting. In hearing, as I have this afternoon, your dialogue, I'm thinking to myself, it's interesting that this could be delivered as a project, actually as a balance sheet component. Believe it or not, in a financial community. That really has delivery, has impact, and fosters dialogue at an area and at a discipline that really gets results. It is a component that can be incorporated into a financial balance sheet. It can actually be applied and developed into that category. We have categories such as charitable contributions, things along that line that are reflected on a normal financial balance sheet. And this is a delivery vehicle that would accelerate any kind of movement, social movement, just by getting ingratiated into the GAAP, International Financial Community. These are multinational corporations. That's the mode nowadays, and that, to me, represents a very strong delivery vehicle. I'd be interested in helping out in a project like that. And you asked at the outset of this conversation, how would it be delivered? How can we facilitate this endeavor? That is a component that nobody's touched on, and that would probably be, in addition to the faith-based community, which is the way it should go, that would be a component that would get it right into the corporate sector. It's quicker than anything I can think of. So that's my two cents, everybody.
Well, it's interesting about metrics, that increasingly people are thinking about another balance sheet for corporations than their traditional one, about how they're investing in communities. Even beyond merely the concept of sustainability and the environment. One thing that's kind of, I think, interesting about human dignity, if you have to actually take our, you know, our nerdy definition of agency and social recognition, that big, broad concept could actually give you something that could measure whether you're doing good. You know, is the Human Rights Council of the UN doing good? Is you know, Walmart doing good or not, you know, in its factories and supply chains feeding into its retail sales. Well, you just measure, like, are people's agency to thrive being extended, and are they getting recognized as, you know, human beings in full who ought to have opportunities? It may sound like human dignity, agency, and social recognition are big abstract ideas, but they might actually give you a way of measuring whether you're doing good.
It is. It's absolutely possible. And it's the World Bank currently has evaluation specialists that go around and do a little lesson, measure the success or failure of projects. And you've got the mechanisms in place right now. It could just be just tooled a bit, and they'd to be accepted ultimately into the financial community as formalized transactions and reportable to the investors and to the community at large. And boy, what a mechanism for delivery that would be.
Yeah.
Great. Mark, we're out of time. I don't know if you want to make any concluding remarks.
Well, I hope that, you know, if there's an opportunity to that you see for a dialogue to be taken up, that you'd, you know, suggest it to me. I'm eager to hear from you in the future. And, you know, it only matters if it tangibly allows people, whether they be women and girls or migrants or minorities or anybody in the world, to have opportunities and freedoms that they haven't to date. It only matters if there's that tangible impact. But I'd welcome your feedback. But this is what the UN, World Bank, corporations, and other institutions should be all about.
Mark Ligon, thank you so much for today's call and to everybody for participating. We've been fortunate to have Mark here at the Council on Foreign Relations, and we're saddened to see him go. But he has been appointed to become the president of Freedom House. So we know you're going to do great work there at that wonderful institution, and we look forward to having you back in your new capacity. But one thing that I'm sure will not change is your Twitter handle. I encourage you all to follow him at Mark Ligon and keep in touch with him that way, as well as new posts at Freedom House. We hope that you will also follow us. We just started a Twitter feed for our Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative, so you can follow us at CFR_religion for announcements and upcoming events, as well as information about the latest CFR resources that we are producing. And as always, I encourage you to send feedback to us. We can get comments or questions to Mark, or we always welcome suggestions of topics and speakers and that we should be covering in this conference call series. So thank you all again, and thank you, Mark Ligon.
Yeah, very, very glad to have joined you. Thanks for hosting this.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.